Welcome back to Slightly Foxed and a second year of discussions about lost and forgotten books. We have some unusual and we hope fascinating episodes planned for the coming months, and we've lined up an excellent collection of expert guests. Today, we are going to set the scene by concentrating on the only New Year's resolution that really matters, which is, of course, to track down and enjoy even more literary treasures. January is the ideal month to dig your reading habits out of a rut and pique your jaded literary palate with fresh genre and a new circle of authors. The Slightly Foxed editors Gail Perkis and Hazelwood are here to guide you on your way, along with two thoroughly adventurous literary guests. My name is Philippa Lamb. We're recording this, as always, round the kitchen table at Slightly Foxed in Hoxton Square, so don't be surprised by anything you hear, really. Before I introduce today's guest, let's have a quick briefing on what Slightly Foxed has planned for 2020. Anna Kirk has nipped away from her desk to fill us in. Morning, Anna.
Good morning.
What's happening this year?
Well, we've now caught up for the most part following the Christmas break. In terms of our books coming out, we're looking to spring with a book called To War with Whittaker, which are some wartime diaries of the Countess of Ranfurly. 1st of March, those will be coming out. And then summer brings The Empress of Ireland by Christopher Robbins, which is all about his fairly eccentric friendship with the Irish film director Brian Desmond Hirst. And then autumn, we will be having Jessica Mitford's Hons and Rebels, which I personally am very pleased about because it's one of my favourites.
Yeah,
so lots to look forward to. We also have, of course, the next two Rosemary Sutcliffe titles coming out, Frontier Wolf and The Lantern Bearers, as well as reissuing Blue Remembered Hills, which was one of our very first Slightly Foxed editions.
Yeah, this is a lot.
There's a lot to come, yes, but we do it every year.
Yes, Anna and I are proofreading like there's no tomorrow.
She must be.
Anna, you've forgotten one more thing. We're going to run a competition.
We are indeed. As many readers will know, we sadly sold out of our Slightly Foxed mug, a lovely creamware mug that had a quote on it from Slightly Foxed issue 1. However, we are now trying to produce a new mug. Unfortunately, the pottery where the first mug was produced has now closed down, so we're seeking out somewhere else to have them made. But we, of course, need a new quote for the mug. So we are looking to ask Slightly Foxed readers and listeners if they have any suggestions, around 20 words or so, that would be appropriate to put on the mug.
This is an excellent idea. When's the deadline for this competition?
The end of April, and it'll be £100 worth of Slightly Foxed goods as a prize.
So. And presumably a mug when the mugs are actually produced.
And we'd like the quote to be, you know, slightly humorous,
nothing too worthy.
Exactly. Thanks very much, Anna.
Thank you.
On to today's discussion, and our guest, John Mitchinson, has worked in publishing for decades with, notably Harville Press. He was Waterston's first marketing director. Now he co-hosts the excellent Backlisted podcast with our second guest, Andy Miller. Andy is an equally ideal person to discuss reading resolutions, having actually written a book on that very subject, The Year of Reading Dangerously. More on that anon, after I just mentioned that this month's pick from the Slightly Foxed archive is a piece about Charles Palliser's mammoth Victorian puzzle novel, The Quincunx. So, John, Andy, welcome.
Hello. Happy New Year.
We're going to be talking about reading more broadly in 2020, essentially. But I don't know how much faith we can put in what Andy's telling us about the things he has and hasn't read, because moving to the book he wrote and the reason for the book, it does rather involve a few, how can I put it, porkies about a book she'd read in the past.
Well, yes. What I would say was a confidence trick. But it's more of a self-confidence trick. I wasn't trying to dupe anyone but myself.
And I think, Andy, am I right in saying that in that you did conclude it was good to finish a book even if you didn't like it?
This has been the theme. Unforeseen consequences of writing about these subjects, that you become an inadvertent advocate of something that you know, even as you advocate it, is not going to be terribly popular. I wasn't seeking to, when I've been fibbing, to deceive anyone. I love reading. I love books. I love the idea of being a bookish person.
I mean, in fairness, you were a bookseller at the time, weren't you?
I was.
So you
were
just encouraging would-be readers.
I was wrong. I was.
I don't think we want to judge, but, you know, life being busy, it is easy to find less and less time for reading. So should we take as our premise that it's a very good idea to refresh our literary curiosity, not just for new writers, but also for new genres, Now, obviously, you do need a really good book to get you started in new and unknown literary territory. So we have come up with a short list of genres, and we're going to see if we can tempt you with a short tasting menu of books for each of them. I'm going to ask Gail to kick us off, and she has chosen as her genre...
History.
Go for it.
The first writer I'm going to talk a little bit about is Barbara Tuchman, who is an American historian. She died in 1989. She was not an academic. In fact, she believed that the constraints of the academic life inhibited good writing. What she wanted to do was to tell a story, and she did so brilliantly on a variety of subjects, the relations between Britain and Palestine. She wrote a wonderful biography of Vinegar Joe Stilwell, who was an American general who served in China during the Second World War. She wrote a book called The Proud Tower, which is a portrait of the world from about 1890 to 1914, so just before the First World War. But for me, her best book is called A Distant Mirror, an account of 14th century Europe. And The Distant Mirror, of course, is that century reflecting the ills and the misfortunes of the 20th century, but I would say that now it equally applies to us. So she takes as her central character a French nobleman called Enguerrand de Courcy, who fortunately lived for most of the century. And she looks at the grand sweep of history. So there's the papal schism, there's the Black Death, there are endless rebellions and uprisings and insurrections. It's the century in which Switzerland fights for its freedom. Beneath that, she looks at the domestic detail, what marriage meant, what childhoods were like then, the effect of taxes and wars on the peasantry, how grocers operated, how clerks operated. She goes through, you know, the full gamut and brings it vividly to life.
John's nodding.
One of my favourite books ever.
Yes.
When we were having the discussion earlier about history books that you felt could stand the test of time, that was one that I feel strongly would make the grade, apart from the fact it's beautifully written.
Yeah.
It's what you want history to be. It's seeing patterns and saying that the past isn't even past, you know, that it's still these cycles, these historical cycles are being replayed in front of us. And understanding the past is the most important thing for understanding the present. And no book I know does that more beautifully. And also it's full of crunchy detail about 14th century life.
Mm. Not to be missed. And it's been reissued, I think, 2 years ago by Penguin, so okay. It's readily available. The next historian I'd like to talk about is Elizabeth Longford's wonderful two-volume biography of Wellington, which... you know, is both history and biography.
You've mentioned this before.
I didn't want to tread on Hazel's toes. I skipped it.
So that's all right.
So can I come to my third?
Of course.
A historian who I've not read, but my husband has, okay. And he has taken to reading out chunks of this in bed. Very irritating.
I'm not going to pass comment on that.
A man called Dominic Sambrook, who has written 5 volumes of recent British history, starting with Suez. The most recent volume has just come out called Who Dares Wins, which basically covers Thatcher's early years and the Falklands.
Okay.
And I am told that as well as all the politics, these books are full of character and anecdote and the texture of daily life. In fact, I've had a lot of things read out to me. So one of my new resolutions is actually to start this quintet of books. But he also wrote another book called The Great British Dream Factory, which is a marvellous account of popular culture in Britain in the 20th century. And he makes the case for us being quite extraordinarily productive, indeed being a superpower when it comes to the imagination. So there are stories about J. Arthur Rank's film industry, Doctor Who, which is watched in practically every English-speaking country in
a
the world.
Industry in its own right, yeah.
James Bond, longest-serving character in film. The Beatles, best-selling ever musical artists. So I think that would be another one on my list to read.
So if you were to sum up why people should explore this particular genre, what would it be for you?
Well, it's storytelling. The best history is storytelling. It just happens to be about real people. And as we know, truth is often stranger than fiction.
John, you're going to take us further afield.
Yes, American literature. Well, it's not classic American literature. There are massively important writers from the 19th century.
Of course.
It's post-war. The first book I want to talk about, it's by Gail Jones, published in 1975. It's called Corregidora, and it was a more or less forgotten novel. It shouldn't have been forgotten because it's a masterpiece. Gail Jones, a writer of colour, and the book was discovered by and published by Toni Morrison. And I think it would be fair to say that the time it's published, it was almost the first book of its kind, much imitated since, indeed, Toni Morrison's Beloved comes out of it, I think. I think it was an important book. I think Toni Morrison said that no other novel by a woman in American literature could be the same without Gail Jones. It's on one level a very, very simple story. Ursa Corregidora is the daughter of a long line of slaves. The shocking revelation that comes very early on in the book is that her great-grandmother was basically bred with the slave master Simon Corregidora from Portugal. He impregnated her great-grandmother and her grandmother. And the job that Ursa is given is to remember, because all the documentation of these women's lives was extinguished, burnt, literally, at the time of the Civil War. And she was to remember the pain and the evil. So she's trying to live her life in 1940s Kentucky, making her life as a blues singer.
A very tough life.
I mean, again, making it sound terribly grim without giving away too many spoilers. She is beaten up, thrown down the stairs, and loses a baby. So she is failing in the one thing that her mother, her grandmother, and her great-grandmother have given her, making generations. But out of this, Gail Jones spins this incredibly intense... It's a record, obviously, of the abuses of slavery, but it's also about how art is the thing that we do to try and make things better, that through the quality of her singing, she is able to somehow transform the inner pain and the wounding. It's written and constructed like a piece of music. It moves backwards and forwards in time. It's like a blues song.
It's an amazing book. The thing about Corregidora, it is very intense.
I mean, fair warning, it's a violent, powerful and extremely... The language is very strong.
But the energy that comes off the page is just something that had to be born, this thing, you know.
Well, she was 26, I believe, when she wrote it, which astonished me, because it's really accomplished, isn't it?
And her own life is complicated, which I don't want to distract anybody onto it at this point. In a way, the whole of Toni Morrison's project, you can see, sort of rises out of this kind of moment.
As you say, this predates The Colour Purple by, what, 7 years?
Yeah.
Which, for me, was almost the most interesting thing.
It is extraordinary.
I'm going to move you on. What's the next one you've got?
The next one, totally different, change of pace, and a favourite book of mine. And I still think if you're looking for the great American novel, and foolishly many of us still are, if you want the kind of the male tradition, the Bello, Updike, Roth tradition, I think Richard Ford's Independence Day is the book I would always give to people, because it's funny. It's not remotely self-important. It is about the most mundane kind of suburban weekend, Independence Day weekend. A man is going to take his son and his girlfriend to visit a baseball hall of fame. His son is troubled and disturbed because he had a brother who died. Frank Bascom is the main character of the book. His marriage didn't survive the death of the child. And now this is Frank. 10 years on, he's 44. He's selling real estate in New Jersey and he's going for a weekend with his son. Now, I think Barbara Ehrenreich said, you know, most great novels have got huge themes to deal with. Richard Ford is basically, all he's got here is he's taking his son for a trip to try and get closer to his disturbed son. Things do go wrong on the trip, with spoilers. The point about Ford, he creates a sense, like no other writer, I think, of what it's like to be living somebody else's life. You are inside the head of Frank Bascom. Frank is funny. He's an idiot. He disappoints himself. He disappoints everybody around him. But somehow, through the brilliance of Ford's language, you are kind of driven on to the end. It's a big book, 450-page book, but it never flags.
It struck me, it is that Updike quote, isn't it? Giving the mundane its beautiful due?
Yes. He talks about the normal, applauseless life of us all. That is very American, very sort of puritanical in a way. We're all equal. We're all screwed up, just in slightly different ways. And like the poet said, the ways we miss our lives are life.
Okay, next.
The next. It's a book of correspondence between William Maxwell, no mean writer himself, who was fiction editor of The New Yorker from 1936 to 1976, the Hemingway era, through to the stories of Tobias Wolff and Richard Fordham. This book, The Happiness of Getting It Down Right, is a book of letters between William Maxwell and Frank O'Connor. Frank O'Connor, the great Irish short story writer, who it goes from 1945 to Frank O'Connor's death in 1967. And it is two things. One is it makes you want to read both the short stories of Frank O'Connor and the short stories of William Maxwell. It's about two men falling in love, really, falling in love over shared passion for literature and precision and clarity of thought. It starts off rather formally with the young Bill Maxwell taking over the job of editing the stories for the magazine. So it starts off, you know, dear Mr. O'Connor, Frank O'Connor was in fact Michael O'Donovan. By the end of the book, they've gone on holiday together, their families have grown up together.
I mean, Frank O'Connor was an extraordinary person in his own right. I mean, a very colourful history we don't really have a huge amount of time for but amazing.
I mean, man of the world. I mean, there are so many great stories. And that was one of the... This book was published in 1996. And I was very fortunate to be publishing Maxwell's work in the UK at that point. It was not long before he died. But what you get out of it, not only do you get under the bonnet amazingly beautiful sequences of how does an editor, what do editors do? How does an editor make a story better? And how does a writer deal with that? You don't have to be a publisher to get pleasure out of it. You will if you are a publisher, I'm absolutely sure of it. But I think if you're interested in the literary landscape of 20th century American literature, then it's just a joy.
And a great introduction to Frank O'Connor's work himself.
And a great introduction to Frank O'Connor's work.
Hazel, you're taking us into entirely different territory.
Well, of course, I suppose you could say that personal writing, biography and memoir and so on includes things like letters, diaries. So it's an enormous field. And of course, at Slightly Foxed, we specialise in memoir, which I do particularly enjoy just because it's the sort of personal voice and it puts a frame around a part of someone's life. Of course, we publish a lot, but I'm not going to mention any of those because they're all in the catalogue on the website. But a memoir that I've particularly enjoyed and that I think is a great memoir is it's called A Tale of Love and Darkness by Amos Oz, which is, I think, a most fantastic book. Amos Oz's parents, I mean, he is really known as a fiction writer. His parents came from Europe, from Poland and from Russia. They were both academic. His father spoke 50 languages. No, sorry, 20 languages.
Even 20 sounds impressive.
Even 20 is quite a lot, isn't it? And his mother spoke 5. They were both academics, and they came over to the Mandate, as it was then. And Oz grew up there in this extraordinary household, which was sort of full of books. And I suppose it's a picture of that very, very early community before partition, what it was like for these very sophisticated Europeans to find themselves almost sort of withering and wilting away in this desert situation, you know, with none of the things that they'd been used to, and how they formed a community, and him growing up in this community. And then when it was declared that there was going to be a state of Israel, his father saying to him, I can't remember his exact words, but you're never going to be frightened to be a Jew again. And immediately, of course, there was an attack. But it's a terribly subtle book. In the 1950s, his mother committed suicide. And in a way, the book is about that and his longing to sort of recover that relationship almost. And his father was quite to the right and Oz was not, and they broke. But it's just a sort of enormous, touching panorama which makes you realise how difficult it is to disentangle what's going on there now. But it does give you some sort of understanding. So that would be my first choice.
Before I move you on to your second, I think I'm going to let John go because I think you've got a plane to catch, haven't you?
I have to go to America to catch up with my reading.
You've got to report back to your...
It's been such a pleasure. I'm sorry
not to
stay longer.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
John is on his way to Heathrow. Hazel, your second book.
My second book is a curiosity almost because it is a memoir written after the author had actually written a novel, which was based on her life. It's called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, is the memoir. And the novel was called Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. And they're by Jeanette Winterson. I think it's sort of fascinating to see the difference and also to hear what she said about it, which was that she wrote the novel first because her memories were really too painful to put down, as it were, baldly as a memoir. I very much enjoyed the novel. It's quite upbeat. But I think that the memoir, it's complementary, really, to the novel. It's like laying one over the other somehow. The memoir, it's about growing up in Accrington as an adopted child in very grim, there were grim, cold days in what I think were the 60s, in this working class background, and with a mother who was a fundamentalist Christian. And the Bible governed their entire lives from the age of 4, I think. This little girl, every day there was a Bible reading, every day there was church. And so she, in a way, she grew up in isolation with this extraordinary mother who was a kind of denier. Her father worked on shift And Mrs. Winterson would never sleep with Mr. Winterson in the same bed. So she went to bed when he went out. So it's an extraordinary household. It was a cruel upbringing, but at the same time, it gave her this feeling for words, the Bible, which was absolutely resonant in their lives. And somehow this little girl managed to survive Mrs. Winterson and even in later life grow to sort of understand her. But the title is taken from the moment when Mrs. Winterson chucked her out, when she realised that Jeanette had fallen in love with another girl.
And she was just 16 then?
She was just 16. There's humour in it. There's tremendous kind of sadness in it. But there is a sort of coming to terms with what happened to her and, in a way, admiring and almost loving her adoptive mother at the end.
Mm.
It's a tremendously sort of wise kind of uplifting. Because of the humour, you don't come away feeling it's been a sort of misery memoir at all. And I think the writing is quite fantastic. But I think it's good to read both. I don't know if anybody else has read them.
I've read Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. I think the thing that's very interesting about Jeanette Winterson is actually she is somebody who has written about and talks a lot about the importance of reading and libraries.
Mm.
But actually she slightly turns the one of the usual things we think about reading on its head, which is that we tend to think of reading as an escape. Winterson doesn't see it like that. Her life was an enforced exile from reality.
Yes.
And reading was the channel back to what the world was like.
Yes.
The world which she was being protected from.
Kept from.
Depending on your point of view.
Yeah, that's a really interesting analysis.
I almost feel as though Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit is Winterson the reader's account of what happened, and the memoir is Winterson the writer's account of what happened. But that is clearly a highly debatable, and I doubt she would see it like that.
I find that fascinating.
Onwards to number three.
Biography, I feel, is a much more difficult area. I've read a lot of literary biographies, and quite often I find that the analysis of all the novels that kind of gets dropped into them somehow in relation to the life is really quite hard work. And especially if you haven't read them all.
And if you're new to biography as well.
Yes, and if you're new to biography. So I'm going to choose a biographer who I think is, she's not just a popular biographer, but she's very, very easy to read, which is Selina Hastings. And she's written biographies of Somerset Maugham, Nancy Mitford, Evelyn Waugh, Rosamund Lehman, all of which I found totally gripping. She's got a certain sort of asperity about her, so she's not soppy, but she's basically...
Like her subjects.
Yes, but she's basically on the side of, you know, the reader. She wants you to enjoy it. She does bring that sort of whole literary world of the first part of the 20th century alive. It's a very particular sort of world. It's a rather well-connected sort of world, but it's a wonderful world to escape into if you're feeling a bit stressed with today. But she talks about, for example, Waugh's grandfather, who wrote an autobiography, and she says his discursive, engaging, nostalgic, and slightly fatuous autobiography.
Oh.
And she's just, you know, she's just got that little rapier use of words.
I loved her biography of Rosamund Lehman.
Yes.
Because it does exactly what the thing you've just outlined with the war. She does a thing in the Rosamund Lehman book where it becomes clear very near the end of the book that she had had personal dealings with Rosamund Lehman and didn't like Rosamund Lehman as a result of those. And you then recast what you've read up to that point and think, wow, you've been tremendously, almost deceivingly polite for the duration of the whole biography till now.
Yes, yes. I highly recommend Selina Hastings. She's accessible, but elegant and insightful, actually.
Sounds great.
So, go for it.
Andy, you have something entirely different again for us.
Yes.
Poetry.
Near the beginning of 2019, I thought, you know what? I'd really like to read a lot more poetry. So in 2019, I read about 80 different poets. And what I discovered was that poetry is mostly about three subjects. Love, nature, and references to a classical education which the poet has had or Virgil signalling, as we call it, where it seems, and I'm not really interested in any of those things to read about. So if you are into those things, for instance, Alice Oswald, who is a great poet, writes only about those three things, love, nature, and the Greeks. So I'm sorry, Alice Oswald, if should you ever hear this. I do like your work, but I'm trying to find different things, things that poets write about that aren't those
things. I thought you were going to say death, actually.
So did
no.
I was waiting for death.
Oh, no, I love death.
As it were.
But doesn't that appear in...
It does, of course.
Yeah, right.
So what's the first one?
So the first one, and I don't even know what half of them were about, but I absolutely loved them because there was a sort of authorial recklessness to it, was 77 Dream Songs by John Berryman. Berryman died in the early 1970s. He was 50 years old when this book was published in the mid-1960s in America. It won all sorts of awards. It is absolutely nuts. Each of the dream songs is an idea or a feeling or a moment that Berryman wanted to capture in his own life. He refers to himself in the third person as the character called Henry. I'm going to read you Dream Song 14. Life, friends, is boring. We must not say so. After all, the sky flashes, the great sea yearns. We ourselves flash and yearn. And moreover, my mother told me as a boy, repeatingly, ever to confess you're bored means you have no inner resources. I conclude now, I have no inner resources, because I am heavy bored. Peoples bore me. Literature bores me, especially great literature. Henry bores me, with his plights and gripes as bad as Achilles, who loves people and valiant art, which bores me, and the tranquil hills and gin look like a drag, and somehow a dog has taken itself and its tail considerably away into mountains or sea or sky, leaving behind me wag.
That's bonkers.
It is, as you say, bonkers.
And that's one of the more comprehensible numbers. Again, you know, we said about Corregidora that John chose energy. Mm. You know, energy is what I'm looking for a lot of the time in writing, and the energy that comes off all these books, different from one another, but Berryman has a particular kind of boozy, depressive energy.
So if you really, really want to try something entirely unusual, that sounds like the place to go. What's number two, Andy?
The second book is by the late Adrienne Rich. It's called Diving into the Wreck. This is one of her collections. This won the National Book Award in 1974 or 5. Adrienne Rich is a fascinating poet whose work is not proto-feminist, but feminist from the era of feminism from the 60s and 70s. I was struck when I read this about how vibrant and angry and relevant and therefore slightly depressing it still felt now.
Yes.
And I thought it might be fun just to read the beginning of the first poem in the book, a poem by Adrienne Rich, of all people, called Trying to Talk with a Man. Out in this desert we are testing bombs. That's why we came here. Sometimes I feel an underground river forcing its way between deformed cliffs, an acute angle of understanding moving itself like a locus of the sun into this condemned scenery. What we've had to give up to get here. Whole LP collections. Films we starred in. Playing in the neighbourhoods. Bakery windows full of dry, chocolate-filled Jewish cookies. The language of love letters, of suicide notes, afternoons on the riverbank, pretending to be children. And on she goes. Even as I read that to you, the hairs on my arm were standing up on end. I mean, I can only tell you what I think that poem is about, and that poem is about, in order for me, the poet Adrienne Rich, to achieve equality with the imaginary man, I've come to the desert because I have to lose so much cultural baggage. I almost have to strip myself of the identity, happy memories, unhappy memories, cultural memories, to begin, just to begin to have the conversation I have to go to the desert with the man so that we are entirely stripped of all baggage.
I mean, that's the thing about poetry, isn't it, about enjoying poetry. Friends of mine who read a lot of poetry say this, it's about the specificity of the particular poem for the thing you're feeling at the time, the mood you're in, the thing you're thinking about. They're consolatory, aren't they, in that they...
Yeah, I think as well, like that Adrienne Rich poem, that's the direct opposite, opening a window onto something else deeply felt, which I'm not in a position to have felt, but which I can feel the power in it. You know,
so
I like seeing the world I don't know about as much as the world that I do know about. I want to find out new things.
I think that's as good a reason as any to give poetry a go, isn't it?
Do.
We must press on, but good
choice,
job, everyone.
Good choices.
Good choices all round, I'd say. Thank you very much. And I hope every listener will have found at least one book to tempt them out of all of them. Remember, you'll find all the books we mention anywhere in the podcast in the show notes. They're attached to the episode. They're on the website, foxquarterly.com. We will have this month's reading from the archive shortly, but first, a word about Slightly Foxed. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. This month's reading. Regular listeners will know we choose one every month from a back issue of the Quarterly magazine. Now, Gail, this one, it's about a genuinely epic novel right up your street.
Yes, it's a piece about Charles Palliser's novel The Quincunx, which I have sitting on my shelves, and to my shame, I still haven't opened it.
You're kidding me.
I'm afraid not. It's a very long book,
it
which is why it's a New Year resolution. But this article by Richard Platt makes a very convincing case for me going to my bookshelves and remedying that.
Some people bring wine to dinner. My friends bring books, which is, I suppose, why they're my friends. One night, a friend presented me with The Quincunx by Charles Palliser, saying, "It's kind of Dickensian, right up your street." The Quincunx is kind of Dickensian, in the same way that the Taj Mahal is kind of a nifty tomb. Even the name of its central character, John Huffam, is lifted from Palliser's great inspirer, Charles John Huffam Dickens. But so to describe The Quincunx is almost to belittle it. At more than 1,200 pages, it is as long as anything by Dickens, with the wheels-within-wheels complexity that Dickens, Wilkie Collins and Conan Doyle together could not have bettered. In addition, Palliser paints his characters with a subtlety of touch that would have made Dickens glad to call them his own. Here we meet Mr. Pentecost. His face, which wore an expression which I can only describe as one of indignant good humour, was red-cheeked and adorned by little half-lens eyeglasses above which bristled a pair of very bushy eyebrows that gave his physiognomy an expression of permanent surprise. A neckerchief carelessly tied, stockings ill-matched, and the act of shaving ill-completed. The Quincunx is a multi-family, multi-generational saga swirling around a lost will, a stolen codicil, and John Huffam, a mollycoddle child who enters life unaware that he may be the heir to a fortune and that his death would allow relatives of doubtful virtue to retain their vast inherited wealth, which is rightly his. We meet our hero first, at the age of 5, and, seeing the world through his eyes, are given the missing pieces of the family story only when they are revealed to him as he sheds the naivety and ignorance of his childhood. At the start of our journey, we are plunged into the world of Regency London. Let us imagine that we are standing, on a wintry afternoon some years ago, in the west end of town. The dust thickens, rendering even gloomier that great prison house of fashionable society, so that all those grim and lofty streets and squares seem, in the gathering mist, to be riding at anchor like so many aristocratic hulks designed for the detention of society and its transportation to the waste shores of fashionable boredom. The grimmest and gloomiest of all of them is Brook Street. The grimmest and gloomiest of all the houses in Brook Street is one whose brightly painted escutcheon over the street door proclaims its aristocratic pretensions. Palliser's knowledge of London seems as bottomless as if he had accompanied both Dickens and Henry Mayhew on their endless walks through the metropolis. Indeed, every aspect of early 19th century England is meticulously described. The hierarchy, duties and rivalries of servants in a London townhouse, the sometimes benevolent and often predatory wretchedness of the poor, the bestial living conditions of insane asylums. We will receive lessons in the laws of inheritance and the language of heraldry, encounter the world of Fagin and Bill Sykes, meet body snatchers, prostitutes, murderers and thieving property speculators. We will shiver atop a mail coach, having escaped a school drawn directly from Nicholas Nickleby, and be betrayed after tantalising foreshadowings by almost everyone who presents himself as a friend. Our journey will conclude with a chase on a dark and stormy night, a clandestine marriage and murder in the ruins of an ancient family chapel. The entire narrative of the novel is constructed with the precision of a Bach fugue. Every passage so precisely crafted, so interdependent as to appear indispensable. Like any perfectly crafted work of art, nothing is superfluous and nothing is left out. A beggar who is turned away from the door will reappear hundreds of pages later. A ladder, seemingly left by accident, will be used for a burglary. A boy who, on a warm spring day, is taught to swim underwater will one day save the life of another boy with this newly acquired skill. The leitmotif of the Quincunx is the interplay of chance and design. Do we perceive design in our lives or merely impose it? But the foundational theme is greed. How it twists, degrades and ultimately destroys everything it touches. And how it so clouds the minds of men that they come to see their most heinous acts through an indestructible rose-coloured glass of justification. Like so much of Dickens, it is a cautionary tale. The Quincunx is the only book that ever made me hyperventilate. On the night I wanted to finish reading it, I glanced at the clock, which was striking 11, and closed the book. I had to get up the following morning for work. If I didn't get to bed, I'd regret it. However, if I made some tea, I could finish the book by the early morning, in which case I'd be a cripple all the next day. I made the tea.
Yeah, personally, I read it twice, and the reason for that was that
it's shaming.
It is impenetrably complicated in terms of plot.
Let me make a note of that.
I mean, it really, really is. I'm not kidding. I had to read it twice to understand how the plot resolved.
I have actually opened it and seen that there are lists of characters that run to at least a couple of pages.
Yeah, which, always a worry.
Well, it's a concern, isn't it?
It's worth the journey, but it's not a fast journey.
One day I will get round to it.
That was taken from Richard Platt's piece about Charles Palliser's The Quincunx. That appeared in issue 22. And thanks to the actor Rory Murphy for reading it for us. That's it for this month. Our thanks to John and Andy for being with us. If you haven't heard their own podcast yet, you must. You can find it on any podcast app. It's called Backlisted. Check out the Slightly Fox website if you'd like to subscribe to the quarterly magazine, or indeed to browse through the books you will find for sale there. FoxQuarterly.com is the place to go. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do take a moment to review and rate us on your podcast app. The more ratings we get, the more prominent the podcast will become. And with more than half our listeners overseas now, we are keen to spread the word even further. We will be back on the 15th of February. Thanks, as always, for listening and for joining us on this month's literary expedition off the beaten track.